Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, November 19th, welcome, 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 and come on in, friends, to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Hear ye, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So we're going to do something a little bit different today. As some of you know, Studio 2, Avi and I and our whole team, we go on the road from time to time to explore different things. And in recent months, we've been exploring the people, places, food, and drinks of the American Revolution. It's part of our celebration of the 250th anniversary of our nation's founding. And one of the places that we visited is a Man Full of Trouble Tavern. It opened back in 1759 on Spruce Street near the Delaware waterfront. It served dock workers. And so we had some great conversation there back in the summer. Do you remember that day, Avi? Yes.
Yeah, I remember.
And so we're going to...
I'm not that forgetful.
I know. And so we're going to listen back to that conversation today. And one of the reasons why I really enjoyed this conversation is because most historical perspectives that you see focus on landowners a lot of times, not necessarily on working class folks. And so this conversation was really about dock workers and people who were working class and how they viewed the revolution, what they ate, drank. And so looking forward to that. Of course, this is all part of our series that we are doing leading up to Independence Day 2026.
And can I just be honest with everybody?
Yeah.
At the top of the show, we had a little time to fill at the end.
Yeah.
So to fill that time, we're also going to do a trivia question that's sort of bar slash tavern themed at the end of the show. We're going to ask the question in about 20 minutes. So stay tuned for the question. And then one of you are going to get to answer that question live on air
on the radio
at the end of the hour. So stay tuned for the trivia question. It's sort of it's like bar style trivia about bars. How about that?
And our listeners tend to like trivia. So
they do.
It's a good reason to stick around.
And I tend to like trivia too. So
this is Trivia King.
I'm the Trivia King. Okay.
That's right.
Trio of local news stories before we get to all of that. And let's start with the big story that everyone's talking about. It finally happened last night. Philadelphia now officially has three
Michelin
restaurants. The big winners were announced last night at a big ceremony. Michelin awarded one star to Her Place Supper Club and Friday, Saturday, Sunday in Rittenhouse, as well as Old City's Provenance. Provenance might be the most interesting winner here. Mm-hmm. It's only been open for a year.
Wow.
And it's already got a Michelin star. And I have to shout out the prophetic Jason Sheehan of Philadelphia Magazine, who wrote a piece right after this place opened about a year ago, basically claiming that this restaurant was being built to win a Michelin star. And this is before we even knew that Michelin was going to be reviewing restaurants in Philadelphia. So he had the crystal ball in this thing, as well as the chef of the restaurant, Nick Basic. So congratulations to Provenance and Her Place Supper Club and Friday, Saturday, Sunday for being Michelin starred restaurants. That's a pretty amazing thing. And they're the first ever in the history of this city.
Yay. Congratulations to all the Michelin star winners. And in case you wondered what the stars meant, one star means high quality cooking worth a stop. Two stars, excellent cooking worth a detour. Three stars is reserved for restaurants that have exceptional cuisine and worth a journey. Our folks got one star, which is really, really cool. And there's like a lot of ripple effects that come with these stars. Like you get a boost of business. So that means we might not be able to get a reservation at this point.
Pack it in. Have you been to any of these yet?
I have not.
Oh,
and I may never be able to go now. That's what you're telling me.
I got to one of them.
Yeah. But, you know, obviously a resident foodie here. But it also boosts staff morale and it attracts chefs. So people want to work at...
This is your claim or their claim?
No, this is a claim. They've done studies about this issue. And the Philadelphia Business Journal cited some of this. And it also makes everybody in the restaurant business in the city want to step their game up. They elevate their food. So we're all going to benefit from the spill-off effects of these restaurants getting their Michelin
star. But this is a live debate. I've seen some people argue that when Michelin comes to a city, what you end up getting is a lot of chefs who open businesses that are aiming to get a Michelin star.
Which is not necessarily.
And so they're going, and Michelin does have a certain type of restaurant it tends to honor, right? And so I think there some people are concerned that you get too much of a monoculture when you become a Michelin city. So I think there's some give and take. But yes, of course, people are hopeful that this will continue to further boost an already ascending food scene here in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I will say, very exciting, at the awards ceremony last night, the Michelin man was there.
The tire guy. Yeah.
I didn't know the mascot came. It's like it's like having the Philly Fanatic or something.
And they got
That's
these
great.
Really cool jackets.
Yeah.
You know, these white jackets. It's kind of, I mean, it's cool. But you know, it is a racket. We talked about this last time where we have to court Michelin to come to Philadelphia and get them to come here. And they finally came.
Buggy on YouTube is pointing out Wawa did not get a star, despite my prediction yesterday.
You did. You said 2 to 3.
Yeah, I also didn't get a Michelin star. And I make a pretty good mac and cheese. But hey, they don't care.
You know, there's always next year.
There's always next year. They're going to be back. Don't worry.
Second story, Philadelphia Mayor Sherelle Parker is speaking out following backlash to her administration's decision to quietly eliminate racial diversity goals for city contracting. The mayor went on the offensive after her critics accused her of quietly capitulating to anti-DEI pressure from the Trump administration. She spoke at a press conference on Tuesday saying while recent Supreme Court decisions that threatens affirmative action programs did play a role, she says she eliminated the diversity targets because the 40-year effort just had failed. For decades, the city had tried really hard to boost diversity in city contracting. They set racial participation targets, and every year the number of Black and brown firms with city contracts sort of remains stagnant. And so the mayor says now she's going to shift focus. She signed an executive order that will prioritize contracting for firms that are small and local. Now, this was a pretty big deal, I think, for a lot of folks to hear the mayor speak out, because she's been pretty quiet, you know, especially with issues that have rubbed, you know, with the Trump administration, talk about sanctuary city status, you know, when the Trump administration was sending National Guards to big cities, the mayor didn't really speak on those things, but she spoke out on this.
Right. Well, I guess her argument is that I didn't solely change this because of the Trump administration or the Supreme Court or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't quite follow her logic, to be honest, as I read the Inquirer's reporting. She was saying that there's sort of a quota system and that it did not result. But she didn't explain is how having the quota system didn't lead to the result. Like, how is it harmful to keep the quota system in place?
She said that it just didn't work.
Didn't explain how the policy was restricting them from meeting the goal. So you could do both. She's saying they're going to give more support to these local small businesses. You could do that and still have
the quotas,
a quota system. Yeah. They don't seem to be at odds or mutually exclusive to me. So maybe I'm misunderstanding. But it sounded a little bit like.
We're moving to a different system now.
I didn't quite understand the logic. I'll just leave it at that. Maybe I'm being dense. I don't know. Story number three. So a lot of folks, you want to own a spot down the Jersey Shore. You can't do it, right? Too expensive. Sky high prices down the Jersey Shore. Who can afford a place down the Jersey Shore? Well, North Wildwood has you covered with a strange type of development called a condotel.
Ooh, what is that?
Thank you for asking. So the story here is from NJ.com. North Wildwood has created this model where old and mid-century beach motels, you know the type, those cool old like 1960s style motels. Retro motels being converted into condos so that each former motel room is individually owned by someone. You can buy an old motel room in North Wildwood for about $300,000.
Wow, that sounds exciting.
Kind of. It comes with all sorts of weird restrictions, like you can't use the condotel as your primary residence. You have to rent it out some of the time, but you can't rent it out too much of the time. Okay, so there's this odd arrangement. You kind of own it, but you also have to kind of rent it. But it's supposed to be a way of preserving these old motels. And there's a pattern of people just knocking these old motels down and building very expensive housing. So this is supposed to be more affordable housing for folks who want a little slice of the Jersey Shore dream.
Yeah, and it's a little slice. The condo hotels are about 350 to 360 square feet.
Yeah.
They include a kitchen in that, okay? And they're being sold furnished. And the furniture looks old, even though it's new. And so I was a little confused because I was like, well, can you upgrade a little bit, you know, if you don't want that kind of bed with the, long pillows? I guess you can.
Yeah, you can,
but,
right?
Or the, but I was wondering if you had to keep it kind of looking hotel-y, right?
Right. Because there is like a Mad Men feel in the whole place, which is fun.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, if you want to own something, it could be a good, you know, investment.
Yeah, lounge out by the pool. Mm-hmm. Real quick before we go, secret fourth story. Someone on Reddit posted this video we want to show you right now. This is a video of a rat on the tracks of the L train. Do we have that video, folks?
Yep, he said
there rat. It is. There it is. Here's a rat on the tracks of the L train. It's posted on Philadelphia Reddit.
Run, rat, run.
Running with a full hoagie roll in his mouth. Congratulations, rat. You are now a Philadelphia celebrity. Remember the New York pizza rat?
Yeah, I remember
a few years ago? This is the Philly answer to the pizza rat, the hoagie rat.
By the way, city rodents are special. They climb walls. They run on railroad tracks. They jump from building to building.
You're like the anti-Eric Adams. You love rodents.
I love city rodents. They're special. So
we love you, rodents.
Here he comes to save the day.
There was probably lots of rodents back in the colonial times, I'm assuming. We're going to talk about it on the other side of this break. Stay tuned to Studio 2 as we go off the rails.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Like we mentioned at the top of the hour, it's been almost 250 years since the Declaration of Independence was signed right here in Philly. To mark this anniversary, we've begun a very special undertaking, a year-long pub crawl.
Yeah, Avi and I have been taking the show on the road, and our first stop was an operating tavern that opened its doors way back in 1759. It's called A Man Full of Trouble, located on Spruce Street near the Delaware waterfront.
It served working class people, especially dock workers. And to understand the significance of taverns in the Revolutionary era, we crammed into this tiny spot in Society Hill along with a live audience. Our first interview was with Dan Wheeler. He's the owner of A Man Full of Trouble. And the obvious first question, where did this name come from?
The phrase comes from the Bible, actually. It comes from Job 14:1, because I know my Bible.
All right.
And it is a man born of woman is few of days and full of trouble.
Do we have any idea why they chose that name, or is that lost to the sands of time?
It's lost in the sands of time. The original name may have been the man loaded with mischief, which comes from a parable. But at some point, the history books changed from calling it a man loaded with mischief to a man full of trouble. I'm not sure why.
I was wondering, too, like, did all taverns have such poetic names, or was this an outlier? Do you have any idea?
I think it was an outlier in colonial times. I think most taverns were called something that could be easily shown on a sign, like a king or a queen or a bull or something like that, because a lot of people in colonial times couldn't read, and even if they could read, they didn't all read the same language. And so just having a picture, saying, meet me at the bear, meet me at the bull, it would be easier.
So take us back. I mean, this place was 1759.
It was built.
Describe that time and what it looked like, because it's been through a lot, and you've done a great job restoring it. But take us back to what this place would have represented for this neighborhood.
Colonial Philadelphia was pretty small. It only went to about, 6th or 7th Street. Down to about South, which was called Cedar back then, and over to Spring Garden. And then that was really it. And the Delaware used to be a lot closer than it is now. And this building itself was built at the confluence of two creeks. It's part of why the building is kind of slanted, if you haven't noticed. Because this was kind of a marshy area, and the building kind of sank over time. But taverns like this, this was a place to come, and it was sort of the center of social life. People could drink here, and people who needed to stay would go upstairs and share beds and share bedrooms. There were just two rooms up there. And then they would lock up the liquor at night. That's why the cage is there, because you couldn't drink legally in Philadelphia very late. And so people would go upstairs, they'd lock up the liquor and start the day over again.
And I wonder, like, what did drinking represent to people? Was it like a chance to relax? Was it a place to share ideas? What did that type of gathering represent to people?
Yeah, I guess it really depends on who came here. And, it's always assumed that it was dockhands and sailors and travelers. But the finest homes in Philadelphia were just right there on 2nd Street. So it's hard to know who came here and why they came. And I think people kept a lot of secrets during a revolution.
Yeah.
So let's go a little bit through the timeline of what happened to this building over the last, 250 plus years, and how it possibly survived, because we are surrounded by the remnants of urban renewal especially in this particular area, but somehow this building is standing. So explain to us how that is even possible.
So yes, it was built in 1759, and there's an adjoining building through that door there, also built at that time. It operated as a tavern for probably 100 years. By then, at the end of the Civil War, the neighborhood had sort of gone downhill, and the tavern era was ending, at least in major cities. And so the building became a food stall in what was then the restaurant market for the city. The Dock Street Market was right here. And it did that for another 100 years or so. When that market closed, the city, you're talking about urban renewal, the city tore down every single building in this neighborhood below 2nd Street, just wiped out every single building, except for this one, because someone saved it. Now, I've seen maps where they're planning Society Hill Towers, and this building's not on the plans.
Yeah, so it wasn't supposed to be saved.
It was not supposed to be saved. The Naur Foundation came along and bought it, and you can't see on the radio, but you can see here the pictures on the wall of what it looked like in 1960. And you can see that just about everything else is already torn down at that point. And the Naur Foundation restored it back to its colonial design, which is what it looks like now. And they had it for about 30 years and donated it to the University of Pennsylvania. And they had it for about another 25 years, and they sold it to me. And so it was ready for another restoration, new systems, new roof, new windows, new a lot of things. But I tried to be as light as I could, to use a light touch, to keep it with the colonial design. And so we fixed what was broken. We left everything else as it was.
Any idea why they picked this particular building to save, the Naurs? I mean, obviously they must have had some interest in preservation, but you know, there must have been, as they were clearing out this area, quite a few edifices to choose from.
Most of the buildings in this neighborhood by then were 19th century buildings. I think this was one of the few 18th century buildings that was still standing. Above 2nd Street, there are many more 18th century buildings. But this was kind of an outlier. And that's why they didn't feel particularly bad about tearing down everything, because it was all sort of 19th century warehouse buildings that got torn down. I don't know if in 1959 this was the only colonial tavern left in Philadelphia, but it was certainly the only colonial tavern left in the center city area.
Got it.
And now it's the only one left at all.
You said something earlier that stuck out to me, and I just wanted to revisit it. You said that this was a tavern for probably about 100 years, and then the tavern era was starting to end in major cities. What does that mean, the tavern era? Because people still like to drink in 1860.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't like alcohol was out of style at that point.
Right, but taverns were more than just places to drink. They were also hotels. And so the last known tavern use that we have for this place was Benjamin Naylor's Hotel. And when you look at it in the photos, you can't believe anyone would stay there. And now you're up to about 1870, and there are beautiful hotels in Philadelphia. Yeah. They've been built on Chestnut Street and on Broad Street, and that's what people started demanding. They weren't going to share a bed.
No one wants to cram into an attic anymore. And that was a big part of the business model.
Right.
You know, it wasn't, you know, they didn't subsist just on the money from the drinks. They had this other revenue stream, and people didn't care for those types of accommodations anymore.
Correct. And that's why when you do your tour here of all these other taverns in the country, very few of them are left in big cities. You'll go out in the country and find them at crossroads, and that's about it, really.
And it stood out to me that you said sharing a bed. Like, tell us about the accommodations. This was a place where people slept. Break it down for us. Give us the visual in our minds of what you're talking about when we're talking about sharing beds. I mean, who was
in
there?
Sounds cozy.
Very cozy.
Well, isn't there a famous story about John Adams and Ben Franklin sharing a bed in a tavern, traveling back from Boston together? It was just done by necessity. Now, people were tougher back then than we are now, right? And so it's two rooms upstairs. And by the way, according to old insurance surveys, this room used to be two rooms as well back in the day, which is hard to imagine why they would do it that way. But now it's still two rooms upstairs, and you could fit 3-4 beds up there and everybody pile in.
Elbow to elbow, shoulder to shoulder.
You know, they work hard. They were tired.
Yeah, if you're tired enough, you can sleep in
Sleep anywhere.
It strikes me that someone going to have a drink here is going to have a very different experience than going into a bar with television screens on every wall and the sound system blaring. Like, do you feel like, just from a business perspective, you can offer people something distinct?
And I think most of the people who come here now come here for the vibe. Yeah. Come here to just go through that door and experience it and just feel it. And I try and, to the extent they wander upstairs to see the museum, I try and talk about the things we talked about today. But most of the people who come are just here to soak it in.
That was Dan Wheeler, the owner of A Man Full of Trouble Tavern. Up next, we'll talk to an expert about working class people in the 1700s. We'll dig into their lives, their jobs, hopes for the revolution, and find out what the area looked and even smelled like.
I also smell some trivia coming right after the break. A Studio 2 mug is up for grabs. Mm-hmm. Gasp. So stay tuned. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Arendt, before we get back to A Man Full of Trouble in Historic Society Hill, folks, it is trivia time. So here's the way this is going to work. I'm going to ask the question. If you think you know it, you have to call this number, 888-477-9499. At the end of the hour, we'll pick one lucky caller to answer the question live on air. If that person gets it wrong, we go to the next caller and the next. So stay on the line. And our winner this week will get a Studio 2 mug. Ooh. All right, here's the question. All right. Since we're talking taverns today, a bar/lounge in Northern Liberties, a former jazz club at the same location, and a former Philadelphia beer brand all share what name? All of those things share a single name. When you know it, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Now, let's get back to our interview.
And let's pick up our conversation with a look at who the patrons would have been at A Man Full of Trouble. We asked University of Pennsylvania Professor of American History, Emma Hart, to help us with this. I started the conversation by asking Emma about the working class and marginalized groups who, like the founding fathers, had their own dreams of the revolution.
So that's a really good question, because the elites, you know, of whom the founding fathers were members, were really a very small percentage of the Philadelphia population. We're talking about 10% of people who lived in Philadelphia that you could truly say were rich or wealthy. And the vast majority of other people would be described as either middling, members of the middling sort, which is today's middle class, or working class or lower class. Most people who belong to the working class or the middling classes would be laborers or artisans, or some of the wealthier ones might be clergymen or lawyers, you know, some of the professions. But the vast majority of them would be working with their hands. And what distinguished them from each other would be that the more middling workers would have more skills. They'd have finished that apprenticeship, maybe with a high-class trade, you know, like a clockmaker or a furniture maker. These were sort of higher-class trades, and you could get quite wealthy. But then poorer people, or tradespeople, they might just be laborers. They might not have any skills. Or they might be something like a shoemaker, which was a trade that was harder to get a lot of money from.
So back in revolutionary times, this tavern here was even closer to the river, mm-hmm. and I assume pretty close to the docks.
Yeah.
What type of work was available along the docks? Who was working down there, and where would they have been in that class system that you laid out?
So there would be people from across all of that sort of class system. There would be rope makers, because, you know, this is the age of sail. So you need ropes, you need sails as well, so there'd also be sail makers. And if you were a master rope maker and you owned your own rope walk, you'd be quite rich. But you'd also have a lot of unskilled laborers working for you, you know, and they would, there'd be a lot of them on the docks too. So, for example, carters, whose job it was just to kind of cart stuff around the city, to transport stuff. You'd also have people who just hauled goods or just fetched and carried stuff for a living. You'd also have a lot of sailors. There would constantly be a lot of sailors around as well on the docks.
And I'm just imagining like people coming in and out, like a sense of movement. I don't know, new people arriving, people leaving. Was there a lot of turnover in the faces along the docks? Was it even maybe cosmopolitan in some way?
Yes, it would be cosmopolitan, especially in Philadelphia, in that you'd hear a lot of languages being spoken. You'd hear German a lot, because this is the period in the middle, so the later 18th century, when you have a lot of indentured servants coming from Germany. They were called redemptioners. They had a special name. But you'd also hear a lot of English language with a different brogue, like the Scots-Irish came in large numbers during that period as well. And, of course, you'd have quite a few people of African descent. You'd have enslaved and free Africans who were sailors and who also worked as part of the labouring classes in Philadelphia.
Yeah, and I wonder, follow-up to that, I mean, what were, you know, African Americans sort of doing at that time? Because it was very expensive to have enslaved people here, mm-hmm. and so people preferred indentured servants. So what was life like, you know, for African Americans here, and especially along the docks?
So, I mean, it really depended what role you were in. If you were an enslaved person in a wealthy Quaker household, for example, you might come down to the docks to fetch and carry things for your master or mistress and take it back to the house. It could be quite a lonely life, because you would possibly be the only enslaved person in that household. And there was quite a small community of people of African descent in Philadelphia. But then if you were maybe a free sailor, you would have a completely different experience. You could have come off of a ship that had come from the Caribbean, and then you could be staying around the docks for a while, and then you'd be headed off to another destination once the ship had been refitted, you know, by all of the people who are on the docks and own those businesses.
And I do wonder, what were the industries? Like, what was happening at the docks? Were we sending goods overseas? What was coming into the docks? Like, what were the goods and things that were sort of being circulated around?
Yeah, so Philadelphia was, on its way to being the busiest port on the Eastern Seaboard in this period. Just after the Revolution, Philadelphia becomes the largest city in formerly British America or in the United States. Wow. And that is based on the bustling nature of the port. So you have ships coming in all the time. It would be overwhelming, I think, by today's standards, in terms of the number of people and the amount of stuff lying around, people, women and men hawking goods, you know, the shouting, the unloading, horses, carts, you know, it would be very easy to sort of get overwhelmed by this crush. And so there were ships coming in from the Caribbean that were carrying goods from Britain's Caribbean colonies, which of course were colonies based on enslaved labor and producing things like sugar and coffee. Then you'd have ships coming across the Atlantic with goods made in Britain for selling to Philadelphians. You'd have ships going back across the Atlantic with things made in this region as well, like flour and wheat. And then you'd also have like local fishing boats. You'd have small fishing boats, the market just up, just a few streets up. Like they had a special Jersey market and a special fish market for people who were selling things from New Jersey and had caught fish. So you'd even have like little boats unloading their catch of fish to sell freshly in the market.
In terms of political control, obviously this is part of the British Empire before the Revolution. Do they have a stranglehold on trade as well, or can a ship come from Martinique, or can it come from France, or is it like that's a no-go zone? This is exclusively dominated by the crown.
Right, it's supposed to be, but it's not.
So
I mean, all of the port records show all of this official business, all of these ships. You know, the ships that are announced in the newspaper are the ones that are legally trading. but there is a lot of illegal trade going on as well. Just, you know, south in present-day Delaware, there's kind of little coves where people sneak in their ships with smuggled goods from the Caribbean. So smuggling from the Caribbean was really the big game in town.
Wow. Pirates? We talking pirates? We got pirate action here?
We got pirate action in the, yeah, earlier on, like in the 1690s to about the 1720s.
It's starting to die down.
But actually there is still, there's still legalized piracy, which is called privateering, you know, which is when you get... And that's really important, actually, when the Manful of Trouble opens in 1759. This is during the Seven Years' War, or the French and Indian War. And so this is a time of lots of legalized piracy or privateering.
Wow.
So, yes, you've got a lot of, you know, slightly suspicious activity going on.
Got to ask you about the role of women during this period. I mean, were women working outside of the house?
It depended, again, very much on what status of woman you were, you know, how wealthy you were. If you were a wealthy woman, you would be part of the Quaker elite, like Elizabeth Drinker, for example. Your job was to be a manager of your household from within the house, be a mother, produce children, and really not to go and work outside of the home, but to work in and manage the home. If you were a poorer woman, then undoubtedly you would be out in the streets working. We know there were lots of small shops and stores that were owned by women. There would be women hawking goods on the wharves and also in the marketplace. There would be women engaged in prostitution as well because, you know, sailors had needs when they came ashore. Yes. And it's also possible, actually. I mean, I don't think it was the case for this tavern, but for other taverns in other cities that I've learned about, women actually got the license for the tavern, and they were the tavern keepers.
And I wondered about that because it was called, you know, A Man Full of Trouble. And, you know, this was a tavern where a lot of men came. Were women welcome in taverns like this? Or would you be like a woman of ill repute or something if you showed up at a tavern?
Yeah, you kind of would be.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, drinking in public in places like this was not something that women of good character did. It was okay to be the tavern keeper if you're a woman, but beyond that. And also perhaps the cook or a server. There would be women, you know, potentially working. I think there's a kitchen in the basement. Perhaps women were down there cooking food because I think the place would also have provided food for its patrons. So that's really the only acceptable roles for a woman to be in a place like this.
Understood.
Yeah.
I have a slightly romantic idea that people are gathering in taverns like this and debating big ideas and deciding whether or not to, you know, start a revolution. Be honest with me. Was that actually happening in taverns? A little bit, a lot of it, none of it. Give me a sense.
A lot of it.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. No, wow. I think the debate that would have taken place in here would have been very different to the city tavern, of course. You know, there you've got, you know, Benjamin Franklin and the other men of learning who are educated in the classics, you know, and are debating Locke.
Enlightenment
and,
stuff,
yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And I think in this tavern it would more be, you know, a discussion about their liberty. You know, the ideas would be on a sort of different level, but this sort of fever of liberty infected everybody.
So I want to get into the stakes for the people having that conversation in a tavern like this. If they choose the wrong side, if they ally themselves the wrong way, what's possibly at stake for them and what can they possibly gain? You know, because I'm just curious for the elites, as their
money,
sort of,
yeah, freedom, yeah, land.
Like, what's in it for them, in a sense? You know, what's the pitch to a laborer when you're trying to perhaps ask them to take part in a revolution?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think the answer is obvious for enslaved African people. And we know that during the revolution, many enslaved African people saw the cry for liberty as an opportunity to argue that they did not have their liberty and this was not okay. So, I mean, it's entirely possible there would have been black sailors in this space who would have, you know, heard about the political times and would be having a discussion about the question of their liberty and liberty in general. I think for white working men, I mean, so the revolution gets its start because of bad economic times. You know, working people, when this tavern opens in 1759, things are great. It's the Seven Years' War, loads of money coming in. Many labourers and sailors are earning more than they've ever earned before. But then things take a radical nosedive around the time of the Stamp Act in 1765. And these people are struggling. You know, their wages have been cut. The cost of living is going up. And so I think that what they're investing in is the idea that the revolution will bring back the good times again, that, you know, they will be able to earn a living wage once more.
That's the voice of Emma Hart. She's a professor of American history at Penn and the author of Trading Spaces, The Colonial Marketplace, and the Foundations of American Capitalism. We're listening back to our Studio 2 on the Road event at A Man Full of Trouble Tavern in historic Society Hill as we approach the 250th anniversary of our nation's founding.
Earlier in the show, Cherry and I talked to the tavern's owner, but we wanted to paint a bigger picture about how working class people experienced this period in history. A Man Full of Trouble opened its doors in 1759, making it Philly's oldest bar and a place to drink, sleep, and of course, talk about the promise of the revolution.
I wonder if the idea of the American dream was sort of born in taverns like this. You know, I have my own romantic ideas, you know, because you think about it, if it's bad times and there's this promise that the system that maybe existed in Britain won't exist here. If you're enslaved, this is your chance for freedom. And I just wonder what sort of comes from that conversation. And how high was literacy? Was this also a place where people shared information, where by word of mouth you learned all the things that were happening?
Yeah, so, you know, although literacy rates were not really very high, they were actually higher than Britain. And also reading was more of a, like, communal activity in the 18th century. So it's entirely possible that there would have been some newspapers or pamphlets, maybe a copy of Thomas Paine's Common Sense in here, and there would have been someone who could read it to the other patrons and then discuss it, even if they couldn't all read it themselves. And coupled with that, you know, this was not before the revolution a completely democratic society, far from it. It was mostly wealthier property holders who could vote. But nevertheless, voting rights did extend further down the social scale. So it's also possible that there were people here drinking here who could vote for the Pennsylvania Assembly for a representative because they had some taxable property. And so they might perhaps be discussing politics with people who couldn't vote and, you know, spreading the idea of these rights amongst them.
Yeah. And was there a sense of economic mobility such that someone who was drinking in a tavern like this could reasonably see themselves someday drinking over in the city tavern? We know that we talked about the fact that the elites are the ones maybe having those high-minded debates about the revolution, but were some of them originally, you know, from this class and were able to move up, or was it pretty stratified and pretty set in place?
No, it was not stratified, especially, you know, again, you've got to compare it to
the old country.
European societies. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And social mobility was considerable in comparison. So I could give you sort of an example of if you were a Scots-Irishman who gets off the boat a few yards from here and you come into the Man Full of Trouble, you're likely someone who, you know, you're going to have to serve a few years as an indentured servant because you couldn't even afford your passage over. There was no hope in Ireland that you would own property, own land. But you came here and then you served out your time and then you were able to go and buy some land in what is now central Pennsylvania, but then was western Pennsylvania, become a landowner. And that's something that you could only have dreamed of if you had stayed in Northern Ireland.
So that's like the American dream.
Yeah.
There. I wonder, you know, we talk about dock workers who came here and working class people, and then down the street there was Ben Franklin. Did folks sort of mix and mingle at that time, or was it the working class stayed over here, the people who were more elite stayed over there? Were there conversations happening between the classes?
Not so much, but they couldn't avoid each other like you can today. because 18th century cities were walking cities. And we've already talked about, right, how small Philadelphia was. And that was by necessity because, like, your only modes of transport were walking or a horse and carriage if you were wealthy. And so even if you were wealthy, you had to live close to all of the services that would run your household, which were provided by working people. So Benjamin Franklin would, it would have been impossible for him to avoid conversations with working people in Philadelphia. I mean, it's unlikely that he would actually have come in here and sort of struck up a social conversation with the people who came to this tavern. But he would likely know them by face, perhaps, or even have dealt with them in a business capacity. Because, it's very easy for us to overestimate how big the city was. It had a population of about 40,000 people, which is small, and a lot of people would have known each other. It was a face-to-face society.
Of course, we all know the famous line, you know, all men are created equal. And we know it didn't apply to everybody, that they weren't truly thinking of all men or all people when they signed on to that language. But were people like Jefferson and Franklin actually conceiving of the white working class as equal to them potentially in this new society? Did they really think that?
I think they believed that white working people had the capacity to become educated citizens. But I think they believed that there was also a lot of danger there. That if you didn't have an educated citizenry who were able to understand the importance of voting, of exercising their democratic right, and be responsible, then there was a strong possibility that the whole experiment would collapse. Really, people like Jefferson and Madison stressed this idea that you had to be an independent gentleman, so no one could influence you, that you could make allegedly neutral political decisions in for the public good, you know, for the good of society. And in order to be able to do that, you had to be independently wealthy. You had to be not beholden to anybody. So that kind of, you know, made it impossible for your average working man to reach to that status.
Yeah, and as we think about what society was like how were people educated? Like, what was the sort of daily life that people lived? Because if you have to be reach this educated class, like, how do you even get there?
Well, exactly. I mean, you need a lot of leisure time. You need money to buy books and paper and ink. And it's really an impossible dream for a lot of working people. So, I mean, apprentices who we've talked about before, they would acquire a lot of useful skills. I mean, and this is kind of the path that Franklin took. You know, as part of your apprenticeship, you'd learn to read and write, to be a good, you know, financial manager. And then once you'd acquired those skills, maybe you could, you know, run a successful business. If you were a successful business person, you would spend, like Franklin, you know, some decades building up a nest egg and wealth and reputation. And then that was the point at which, and you had to, of course, constantly improve yourself through reading during that time. That was the point at which you might be able to become an independent gentleman, if you even live long enough, because we know, right, that mortality was much higher during this period.
Wow. I have to ask you before we wrap, what was the alcohol like?
Was it delicious?
What was the beer like? I mean, what was the drinking scene like? Do we have a sense of, do we actually know what these folks were drinking?
So, yeah, we do. I think, as Beans mentioned before, you know, beer was really like water. You know, it was a safe substitute for water, which was highly unreliable. So this is something that I wanted
were
to
people
squeeze
drunk
in.
All the time?
Yes. This is one thing I wanted to squeeze in, is that we're next to the former Dock Creek, which was so revoltingly polluted by the 1740s that it was filled in. It had been filled up with, like, offal and rotting entrails by butchers and tanners. And so
sounds smelly.
Yes. So, I mean, and so the water in that creek was just disgusting. And so beer took that role of water. But then people would be drinking large amounts of hard liquor, like rum, watered down rum as well. Yeah, so rum became a staple because of the trade in sugar and molasses from the Caribbean. And I think there's a historian from a good while ago who estimated that the average adult male American was drinking about 4 or 5 units of alcohol a day.
Whoa. Maybe that has something to do with the longevity at the time. Because you're drinking a lot year after year, day after day.
Yeah.
Wow.
on that note.
As we digest that information, Emma Hart, thanks so much for joining us. This was a wonderful conversation.
Yes.
Thank you.
We're going to have a little chance for Q&A if anyone has any questions or wants to add to the conversation.
And just say your name, and your question.
So, hi, I'm Kathy Neary. So can you talk more about the mortality rate? Like, how long did people live? And was there a difference between men and women?
So it's I'm going to have to talk in generalities because, of course, the records are very poor. We don't really know of an average mortality. I mean, in Philadelphia, it was pretty good. You know, men could expect to live until their 50s on average, perhaps, which is quite good going, or maybe even 60s. I think women, if they survive the childbearing years, could also live a long life. Like many sort of Quaker women in the city who kept diaries, kept them for a very, very long time because they lived a long life. But Benjamin Franklin was extraordinary. I mean, the fact that this guy lived until he was so ancient was part of why we remember him. And it's also, you know, his longevity is really sort of works in his favor. Because a lot of people were cut down in their prime. Yeah.
I heard you mention about food being served in a place like this, and I'm wondering, with no refrigeration and the technologies that we take for granted, how was food? I wonder if it was good, or you just ate to stay alive, or how that worked.
That's a really good question. People depended really on getting things fresh from the market, or being able to get it fresh from their own supply. You know, there were people who kept cows in Philadelphia, and if you wanted milk, you would actually just get it straight from the cow that would be in the backyard or in the suburbs of Philly. Wealthier people would have their own gardens where they would be able to, you know, pick fruit and vegetables. And then there was the market on Market Street. There was also South Market by the time this place opened, which is still the market that's still standing. People would go there, you know, just on a daily basis to try and get fresh fruit and vegetables. But still, there'd often be complaints about smells and things that weren't so fresh. And especially during the summer months, the fish market was not a place you wanted to be hanging out. And then, of course, they you know, the winter months, people would have to be eating preserved food. So salt beef, peas, porridge, green peas and beans and things that have been dried to keep them preserved that you can make a porridge from. And that food was pretty disgusting. I read complaints about, you know, it's like, oh no, not salt beef again. It's just disgusting.
I'm really getting a strong sense that it smelled bad.
Yeah, I was wondering about the smell and the sanitation. I'm just wondering what it was. What would you smell if you walked down the streets of 1770 Philadelphia?
Well, again, so let's go for a summer portrait here, because that's when it's at its worst. Well, I mean, you've got lots of animal droppings. There are people who are employed to sweep away the pig poo and the horse droppings, and so also householders are responsible for paving the street outside of their house.
You paved your own street.
You were responsible for keeping the sidewalk in good condition outside, which helped, you know, keep the dust down and helped it be less stinky. But it was a constant struggle.
Let me thank you again. Emma Hart, professor of American history at the University of Pennsylvania, also the author of the book Trading Spaces, The Colonial Marketplace and the Foundation of American Capitalism. Emma, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure too.
All right. Special thanks to volunteer historian Robert Strauss and engineer Adam Saniszewski and the folks at A Man Full of Trouble Tavern.
That was fun. Nice conversation. And now it's time for our trivia question reveal. And look, a lot of folks are waiting on the line that we're probably not going to get to. So I just want to just shout them out for, you know, staying on the line, like Diana from Eagleville and Bertie from Kensington and Frank from Point Breeze and Jake from South Philly, Donald from Wilmington, Michael from Broomall. We might not get to you because first we're going to bring on Matthew from New Hope.
All right, you get first crack
at this thing, Matthew. How you doing?
Great.
All right. I think you probably know the answer. I'm going to ask it again, though, since we're talking taverns today.
Mm-hmm.
A bar/lounge in Northern Liberties, current bar, a former jazz club at the same location, and a former Philadelphia beer brand all share what name in common? Matthew from New Hope. The answer is
Ortliebs.
Yay! Matthew nailed it. All right.
How'd you
know
it, Matthew? Which one of those three did you know? All three?
Ortliebs Jazz House.
Yep.
All the time.
Absolutely.
Love that place.
Do you remember what the beer was nicknamed, Ortliebs, when it was a beer company?
You know I don't.
It was called the Wet Beer. The Wet Beer. Very
wow.
strange tagline. But Matthew is absolutely right. So in the 1980s, the former company store on 3rd Street was revived as Ortlieb's Jazz House. Great jazz club in the city. Apparently Matthew was there. Then the jazz club closed in 2010 and was repurposed and refurbished as a bar called Ortlieb's, which it is today. So Matthew, congratulations. You have to stay on the line
so we
can
get your
information and send you that Studio 2 mug. Matthew, thanks for tuning
Yay,
in.
Matthew.
And again, congratulations, Matthew from New Hope.
Wow. Matthew nailed it to the wall. First caller. But you said whoever, if you wait on the line,
you know it.
You know it. And Matthew got it.
Wet beer, Cherry.
Wet beer.
I don't like that tagline.
No,
I don't care for that.
Because beer is wet.
It's supposed to be wet. And
yeah,
if it's dry. If it's wetter than normal,
I don't know
why. But anyways, great job by Matthew from New
Hope.
And
our mug is really cool. So this is a nice mug.
You could put wet beer in the mug.
You could put wet beer in and all that.
Any sort of liquid. They're all wet.
And by the way, thank you to all the folks who came out with us at A Manful of Trouble during the summer. That was really cool. So they got to sit in there and it was a really warm day. So those are memories baked in.
We are sweat bonded together, you and I. We'd love to see you guys at a future event. We actually had an event last night on our tavern tour, and we're going to hopefully do a few more before the Independence Day 2026 rolls around.
And thanks to everybody who came out last night. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan, with editing help today from Paige Murray-Bessler. Thanks, Paige. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Adam Staniszewski engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow. And stay tuned, by the way, for our Up Next preview. It has some very special instructions about tomorrow's show. So stay tuned for that in about 15 seconds.